राधा माधवा कुंज बिहारे, गोपी चन पाला पागिरवार धारे, गोपी चन पाला पागिरवार धारे, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यशोद नंदन व्रज जन रंजन, यमुन तीरा वन चारे, यमुन तीरा वन चारे, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारे, जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारे, जय ओम विष्णुपाद परमहंस परब्रह्म सरस्वती सति श्री श्रीमद् डिवाइन ग्रेस एसी भक्ति विनोद स्वामी महाराज श्री प्रभुपाद की जय। इस्कॉन BBT Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga Haribo. Sorry for the senior moment there. It happens. Yeah, it's Mother Mukti was saying, the deities just look especially beautiful today, don't they?
They sure do.
I love that outfit. I like the ukulele this morning, too. Okay. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So today we're reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 18, Text 49 and 50. Okay, so we'll do the Sanskrit together on 49. Iti putram kṛtāgheṇa. So nutapto mahamuni,
swayam
viprakrito
rajya,
naivagham tadachintayat, iti putra kṛtāgheṇa, so nutapto mahamuni,
Svayam
viprakrito
rajya,
naivagham tadachintayat, iti putra kṛtāgheṇa, so nutapto mahamuni,
Svayam viprakrito
rajya, Naivagham tadachintayat.
Iti putra kṛtāgheṇa. So nutapto mahamuni. Svayam viprakrito
rajya.
Vaishnavis. Iti, thus, putra, son, krita, done by, akena, by the sand, sa, he the Muni, anutapa, regretting, Mahamuni, the sage, swayam, personally, viprakrita, being so insulted, Ragya, by the king, not. Eva, certainly, Agham, the sin, Tat, that, Achintayat, thought of it. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The sage thus regretted the sin committed by his own son. He did not take the insult paid by the king very seriously. Purport. The whole incident is now cleared up. Maharaj Parikshit garlanded the sage with a dead snake was not at all a very serious offense, but Sringi's cursing the king was a serious offense. The serious offense was committed by a foolish child only. Therefore, he deserved to be pardoned by the Supreme Lord, although it was not possible to get free from the sinful reaction. Maharaj Parikshit also did not mind the curse offered to him by a foolish Brahmin. On the contrary, he took full advantage of the awkward situation, and by the great will of the Lord, Maharaj Parikshit achieved the highest perfection of life through the grace of Srila Shukadeva Goswami. Actually, it was the desire of the Lord, and Maharaj Parikshit, Rishi Samika, and his son Sringi were all instrumental in fulfilling the desire of the Lord. So none of them were put into difficulty because everything was done in relation with the Supreme Person. Text 50, I'll just read. Prayasha sarvo loke parayar dvandveshu yojita nevyatani nakrishyanti yata atma gunashraya. Generally, the transcendentalists, even though engaged by others in the dualities of the material world, are not distressed. Nor do they take pleasure in worldly things, for they are transcendentally engaged. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The transcendentalists are the empiric philosophers, the mystics, and the devotees of the Lord. Empiric philosophers aim at the perfection of merging into the being of the Absolute. Mystics aim at perceiving the all-pervading Supersoul. And the devotees of the Lord are engaged in the transcendental loving service of the personality of Godhead. Since Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are different phases of the same transcendence, all these transcendentalists are beyond the three modes of material nature. Material distresses and happiness are products of the three modes, and therefore the causes of such material distress and happiness have nothing to do with the transcendentalists. The king was a devotee and the rishi was a mystic. Therefore, both of them were unattached to the accidental incident created by the supreme will. The playful child was an instrument in fulfilling the Lord's will. Thus, in the Bhaktivedanta purports of the first canto, 18th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Maharaj Parikshit Cursed by a Brahmin Boy. So that's the end of the chapter, and we get a very, very good lesson, particularly in the purport 49, and then a little bit at the end here of 50. And the basic idea is that, first of all, Krishna is in control of everything. Everything is going on by his will. And secondly, that he fulfills many purposes by his pastimes. So, in other words, here it's described that all of these pastimes were arranged by the Lord. So it wasn't that Sringi was some evil little kid or something, and or was going, you know. In other words, yes, he said he was foolish and he was ignorant, but also it was part of Krishna's pastime. His Lila Shakti, Achinta Shakti, which we'll talk about, covered them so they were all instrumental in this. And this served many purposes. And one of the main purposes, so first of all, that Maharaj Parikshit could, of course, become completely absorbed in Krishna at the end of his life and go back to Godhead, and of course, so the Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken. What could be more important for the entire universe than the Srimad Bhagavatam being spoken, which is really it's like our flagship scripture. I don't know if that's quite the right term for it, but it's like the one that we hold up above all else. And of course, it was spoken directly to Maharaj Parikshit by Shukadeva. So all of this was the setup for that, so that would happen. And Prabhupada explains how this was arranged by the Lord. And Prabhupada says, actually, it was the desire of the Lord, and Maharaj Parikshit, Rishi Shamika, and his son Sringi were all instrumental in fulfilling the desire of the Lord. And he states that none of them were put into difficulty. Why? Because they're fulfilling the desire of the Lord. So in other words, he's saying even though Sringi, should have had some reaction for this terrible thing that he did, because Maharaj Parikshit was really blameless and Samkirti Rishi didn't find him at fault, but to curse a great devotee and king obviously would be a great offense. But Prabhupada is saying here, because this was all Krishna's arrangement, none of them would suffer. Now, I think this is a very interesting point of philosophy when we think of it. The many examples of Krishna fulfilling several desires, different plans simultaneously. There's so many stories in the Bhagavatam and other scriptures where Krishna has multi-purposes. He's not just doing one thing. He may superficially seem to be doing one thing, but there's many things behind that. One of these is an example of the story. Remember Aniruddha and Usha? They get together, and of course, this is in Banasura's house, and he's not too happy about it. So there's this big battle, and Aniruddha is captured. And in 1062-33, it's described, the Acharyas explained that Banasura could not actually capture the powerful grandson of Lord Krishna. However, the Lord's Lila Shakti, or pastime potency, allowed this to happen so the events described in the next chapter could take place. In other words, Krishna uses that Lila Shakti, his pastime potency, to create another further set of events. So, of course, what happens in the next chapter is that there's this big battle of Banasura, Lord Shiva gets involved. Krishna, of course, defeats them all. In a purport by Vishnu Chakrai Thakur to this verse, he says, or to a later verse, it says, Rudra fought on behalf of Banasura just to show Banasura his faults by making him experience suffering. He is addressed as Bhagavan, Lord Shiva, who indicated he was omniscient, and thus he fought to show the greatness of Krishna by being defeated by Krishna. This is the opinion of ancient authorities. Shiva entered the battle for two reasons: to increase Krishna's pleasure and enthusiasm, and second, to demonstrate that Krishna, although enacting human-like pastimes, is superior to any other avatar such as Lord Ram. So he wanted to properly punish Banasura. He wanted to demonstrate that Krishna was the supreme. And he also just wanted to give Krishna pleasure, because sometimes Krishna likes to fight. He provided that. Shiva, you could imagine, would be a pretty good opponent. If you give him a pretty good battle, and so they would have fun doing that, I guess. Anyway, it says, as in the case of Brahma, when Brahma was, of course, put into illusion, Yogamaya, instructed by the Lila Shakti, bewildered Shiva and his followers in order to give pleasure and enthusiasm of fighting to the Lord, in order to show the supremacy and extraordinary qualities of Krishna over all other avatars. So, another example is when Balaram goes on pilgrimage. Remember before the battle of Kurukshetra? He was probably the only person, any Kshatriya of any magnitude whatsoever, who did not participate in the battle. The whole world was involved, the whole known world then, was involved in the battle, except Balaram. Why? First of all, he sort of recuses himself. When you have a conflict of interest, you recuse yourself from the situation. He had a conflict of interest because, of course, he was sympathetic to the Pandavas. They were his cousins. But he was also sympathetic to Duryodhana. He was Duryodhana's instructor in learning to fight with a club. So if your pupils on one side and your relatives on another, so he decided, I'll just leave and go on pilgrimage. But he also had some other purposes in mind. First of all, he had to find his way to Naimisharanya, he had a pupil, Romaharshan Sutta, who was sort of acting like he was the guru or the main speaker, and he was not qualified at all. In fact, he insulted Lord Balaram, who wouldn't even stand up to recognize the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, you know, he had to do his usual thing with the kusha straw. And then, so then Sutta becomes installed, and Sutta is able to then speak the Bhagavatam that he had heard from Shukadeva Goswami. Then he atones for the pilgrimage, and he kills the demon Balvala. So all these purposes were served by that act. So Krishna and Balaram are often doing this. In fact, even Krishna's devotees are often instrumental in fulfilling different purposes. Narada Muni, I think, is famous for this, right? He's always involved in some messenger. He's like an activator, an instigator. You know, sometimes it seems like he's almost like causing trouble, but he's not. He's fulfilling Krishna's plans. He's helping to make everything fall into place. For instance, Narada sort of encouraged Kamsa to kill the sons of Devaki, didn't he? He said, well, you better be careful. You never know for sure which one is going to be the one that's going to kill you. So, in other words, why would he do that? Now, the prophet explains in the at the end of chapter 1 of Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, there's these end notes. We've seen them, but they're very, very interesting. Prabhupada has several pages of additional explanations and notes on many of the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's really good. I was just rereading it this morning. And here he says, no one can blame Naradaji for encouraging Kamsa to kill the sons of Devaki. The Saint Narada is always a well-wisher for human society, and he wanted the Supreme Personality of Godhead to descend to this world as soon as possible so the society of demigods would be pleased and would see Kamsa and his friends killed by Krishna. Kamsa would also attain salvation from his nefarious activities, and this too would be very much please the demigods and their followers. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti remarks in this connection that Narada Muni sometimes did things that were beneficial for the demigods and the demons simultaneously. So, of course, he brought about the advent of Krishna very quickly. He also helped liberate Kamsa. And of course, there was also some other stories about the six sons and the sons of, who were the six sons? Kalanini? Anyway, there's a whole other side story about that and why that happened. So many different purposes there. And remember the twin Arjuna trees. That's another one where Narada was involved. He cursed Manigriva and Nalakavara to become trees, first to teach him a lesson, but then also gave them the opportunity by appearing as trees in Nanda Maharaj's courtyard to see Krishna. And then, of course, when Krishna pulls the trees down to become liberated. So the trees are liberated, they're also kind of properly chastised by Narada Muni, and Krishna provides a wonderful pastime for his parents and others, you know, to appreciate his babyhood pastimes. So all of these things are going on. And many of them are difficult to understand. And that is why this potency of Krishna is called Achinta Shakti. Achinta, of course, means inconceivable. So it's Krishna's inconceivable energy that he does so many things. In a room conversation, Prabhupada was talking, I think he was talking to some of the scientists, like Srivadamana Maharaj, and he was saying things like, we cannot even understand how our bodies work. We don't know how our hair grows, how our food is digested. You know, so these things are inconceivable. So he says, even we as human beings have little amounts of Achinta Shakti. And Prabhupada said, I cannot explain how my fingernail is growing out of my finger. It is beyond the power of my brain. In other words, it is growing by inconceivable potency, the Achinta Shakti. So if Achinta Shakti exists in an ordinary being, imagine how much Achinta Shakti God possesses. So, of course, this idea of Achinta Shakti is actually very critical to our philosophy, because if we had to summarize, well, what is your Krishna conscious philosophy? Obviously, coming from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it's Achinta Beta Beta Tattva, right? That's sort of the philosophical framework of our Vaishnava philosophy, which, of course, means inconceivable, simultaneous oneness and difference. Now, you know, this is something we've all learned probably from the first, or maybe not the first day we came in contact with Krishna consciousness, and very soon on. This idea of we are one with God, in quality, but certainly different in quantity. Krishna is one with this material world, material energy, in one sense through his energies, but he's also removed. He's also aloof. So we can see this in so many ways. And there's always been these two competing philosophies in the sort of the whole history of Vedic knowledge. And we have Sankaracharya's, what he called it, Vaivartavada, which is a theory of illusion. Everything is Brahman. And if we perceive any differences, they are false. Those are illusions of Maya. If we see anything different, everything is one Brahman spiritual energy. Now, in contrast, the Vaishnava Siddhanta is called Karanamavada, which is the theory of transformation. So, transformation is a very different thing. It says God creates this world and everything that we know in this material world and the spiritual world through his energies, through his potencies. So he's not transformed, but he remains one, but his energy is transformed. So that becomes fairly easy to understand, especially the way, not the way I explain it so much, but the way Srila Prabhupada would explain how, you know, yes, God has unlimited energies and they expand in all different ways. They transform, but he remains unchanged. Krishna remains the same Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not that he's diminished. He has to give up half of his energy to, you know, to create the material universe or something. So, and Srila Prabhupada has explained that material intelligence cannot really understand this. The inconceivable potency and strengths and abilities and energies of the Lord are really very, very difficult to understand. But it is possible, Prabhupada says, for the devotee with transcendental knowledge. So, of course, Srila Prabhupada tried very, very hard and often successfully to give us all transcendental knowledge. Through his books, through his lectures, he just constantly was explaining this philosophy. Because, first of all, one has to sort of intellectually understand and be a little bit convinced, the mind intelligence has to be convinced. Then, of course, the heart has to be convinced too, and realization comes about. And that realization, of course, comes from service, from bhakti, from devotional service. But at least there has to be the intellectual understanding of how this works. So, of course, Prabhupada gave us both. He gave us both the knowledge and he gave us the process of developing bhakti for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I think it was interesting that even new devotees would have some appreciation of this very deep philosophy and transcendental knowledge and how in Krishna's inconceivable energies. I was thinking that when we were new devotees, I think it still goes on in many places and temples, they used to always like to read Krishna book. Like at prasadam, we would read Krishna book, or sometimes during the night, evening, we have milk prasadam, something we come back from Sankirtan and have some prasadam, and somebody would be reading Krishna book. I remember in Los Angeles at lunch, at, you all know Amala Bhakta, your Maharaj now, he has this sort of radio announcer voice. He's got this tremendous voice, you know, he does a lot of tapes and stuff. He would read Krishna book every lunch, you know, remember that. Now in the beginning, it's not like we had a whole lot of knowledge. Krishna book's 10th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says you're supposed to thoroughly study the first 9 cantos before you can enter into the 10th canto. We only had 2 cantos published. We only had first and second canto of Bhagavatam, so we certainly couldn't have done that. But Prabhupada, through his mercy, gave us the 10th canto in the form of the Krishna book. Probably foreseeing, knowing that he may not, you know, live long enough to finish, which was the case. But he did give us, he gave us those pastimes. Why? To enliven us, so that we would know about Krishna. And many of those pastimes definitely fall into the category of achintya shakti, don't they? I mean, think, well, you know, we got Krishna marrying 16,000 wives, lifting up mountains, jumping off mountains 18 miles high, battles with billions of soldiers. I mean, you know, this was, I mean, for the, you know, for the material mind, these are real stretches. This is achintya, inconceivable. But somehow we understood it. I don't know if we understood it. Actually, I take it back. I don't think we did fully understand, but we appreciated it. We enjoyed it. And, you know, we relished hearing about Krishna, even as very new devotees with not a whole lot of understanding. Part of it, of course, is because of Prabhupada's strong conviction. We sort of, our faith became strong because of Prabhupada's faith. You know, Prabhupada was never tentative or wavering. Do you ever hear Prabhupada say something like, well, it seems like if we study everything, our best guess is probably Krishna is the supreme, no. Krishna is God, Krishna is the supreme. You know, I mean, it's like every scripture says it, our acharyas say it. You know, it's like Prabhupada's faith was so strong, so unwavering, his conviction was so great, and his ability to explain it to us so that we could understand it was so fantastic that, yeah, we accepted it. And I remember I used to think, a lot of times I hit some new point of philosophy, and I would think, I may not fully understand this, but, you know, in time I will. I believe it, I have faith in it because Prabhupada is saying it, and I know that after I chant Hare Krishna long enough, you know, so many years, I maybe I'll be able to understand this. You know, it's like, I think we all have that kind of, and all of you do. I mean, devotees have that kind of faith. You know, we get this. And so therefore, yeah, Krishna doing all these things, I never found it really particularly, of course it's amazing, but I didn't find it incredulous, let's put it that way. You know, it seemed like, sure, he's God, why not? What could God not do? If God is the supreme, if he's in control of everything, if he's made everything, you know, what couldn't he do? He did anything through his energies, through his inconceivable, you know, energy. And Krishna also, as I mentioned a couple times in some of these verses and purports I read, he employs his Lila Shakti to make all of these different pastimes happen. And of course, the Lila Shakti is part of Krishna's internal potency. It's a spiritual energy, and part of that is the Lila Shakti. Here's an example. This is from Chaitanya Bhagavat, Adilila 8.8. So this is Bhakti, translation Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's purports to Chaitanya Bhagavat. He says, in spite of the Lord's personal presence, the arrival of wicked Putana in Vraja and her disturbances there were only to nourish the pastimes of the Lord, which give pleasure to the entire world and increase the love and affection of the Vrajavasis headed by Yashoda. These incidents are all arranged by the Lord's Lila Shakti, or pleasure potencies. So again, these different energies of Krishna help to arrange all of these pastimes. And even Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. This is from Madhya Lila 1365. It said, indeed, the personality of Godhead forgot himself in the course of his transcendental pastimes, but his internal potency, Lila Shakti, knowing the intentions of the Lord, made all arrangements. And then Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain in the purport how he exhibited his mystic power by presenting himself simultaneously in each and every Sankirtan group. So, again, so Lord Chaitanya expanded himself so every group of Kirtan thought he was with them, dancing and chanting and singing with them. And often, you know, they wouldn't be able to necessarily see this. A few devotees could, probably Nityananda could, a few. But for the most part, no. They thought, oh, Lord Chaitanya is with us, you know. So Prabhupada says, by his internal potency, everything is arranged perfectly. That is the difference between internal and external potency. In the material world, the external potency can only act after endeavor at great length, but when the Supreme Lord desires, everything is performed automatically by the internal potency. So that's another thing. It's not like, you know, when Krishna wants to do something, create something, make something happen, you know, he doesn't have to endeavor like we do. It's not like you got to make a plan, hire some people, get some. No, I mean, Krishna just is like the thought. I want this to happen. Krishna has a desire. And that desire manifests. Yeah. So we often see Krishna expand himself like Lord Chaitanya did for the pleasure of his devotees. And we can think of so many examples in the Rasa dance. Krishna expanded so that he was with every single gopi. I think sometimes it says millions. I mean, at least there were 16,000, but I've seen some places that millions of gopi. He expanded himself so he, every single gopi thought, oh, he is with me, he is my partner. You know, that was just so wonderful. Because Krishna always wants to give all of his devotees opportunity to have personal relationship with him, to experience that, in the spiritual world, of course. You know, all the coward boys would often think Krishna was just next to them when they'd be doing something or playing or herding the cows or whatever. Whereas he expands with the queens in Dwarka into 16,108 Krishnas. So each one of them thinks Krishna's my husband. He has palaces and he's there with each one of them. So he's always doing this for the benefit of his devotees. Think about during the Brahma Lila, where he expanded as all the cows and the coward boys when Brahma stole them. He expanded as all, and he has millions of cows. So he expanded as all these cows so every cow mother could enjoy the calf as their child. You know, in other words, so the reason he expands himself is not, you know, like necessarily for himself, but it's for the sake of his devotees. And of course, he loves to have multiple relationships with so many devotees. You know, Krishna doesn't want to just have one relationship with one person. He wants to have billions of relationships, and they're all loving, wonderful relationships of mutual loving exchange and service. So while Krishna performs these wonderful acts, there's the Chinta and Lila Shaktis, the devotees are often unaware that it's happening. They don't see Krishna with all the others, they see Krishna with themselves. Now, of course, working along with these Shaktis, it was mentioned once, is Yogamaya. So Yogamaya is Krishna's power of illusion, spiritual illusion, or spiritual potency, sometimes we think, or internal potency. So Krishna has two powers of illusion, Yogamaya and Mahamaya. And Prabhupada says in purport to 10.125, in the spiritual world, the Lord's potency works as Yogamaya, and in the material world, the same potency works as Mahamaya, exactly as that electricity works in both the heater and the cooler. Isn't that interesting? I really like that example. When you think about it, electricity, same electricity, same energy, goes into the heater, manifests as heat, goes into the refrigerator and air conditioner and manifests as cold. So Yogamaya, of course, exists as the internal potency in the spiritual world and even the material world, Yogamaya will come. But for most part, in the material world, expands as Mahamaya, material energy. This is from Prabhupada's endnotes, again, from 10.1, Bhagavatam. In other words, the entire creation has two divisions, transcendental or spiritual and material. Yogamaya manages the spiritual world, and by her partial expansion as Mahamaya, she manages the material world. As stated in Narada Pantaratra, Mahamaya is a partial expansion of Yogamaya. Bewildering the conditioned souls and liberating the devotees are both functions belonging to Yogamaya. So it's also explained there that the two mayas, Yogamaya and Mahamaya, work in different ways, even in the pastimes of Krishna. Because it's described here like Krishna's Rasa Lila with the gopis, gopis' bewilderment, were all arrangements of Yogamaya, where Mahamaya has no influence. But it said, on the other hand, there were asuras headed by Shala and Kshatriyas like their Yodhana, who were bereft of devotional service and could not understand Krishna to be the supreme persona of Godhead. This was also bewilderment, but this bewilderment was due to Mahamaya. So for the non-devotees, it's Mahamaya working to bewilder them so that they don't know Krishna, they don't understand Krishna. Right? Krishna says, fools deride me when I descend in my human form. And Prabhupada said once in one lecture conversation, he said, when Krishna appeared on the planet, personally appeared, he's performing all these activities, he said maybe 50 people understood he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So most of these people are under illusion. And under the influence of Mahamaya, or just we just say Maya, often or illusion, one could not even understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead when he personally appears. That's how strong it is. Now, a feature, of course, of Yogamaya is that Yogamaya develops and preserves the relationship of the devotees with Krishna, and particularly preserves the specific rasa that they have. So often, in other words, if the devotee is in a parental rasa, Nanda and Yashoda don't want to think of Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, right? But that's not. But they're not under Mahamaya. They're not under illusion, under Maya. They're under Yoga Maya. Totally different. Because the purpose of Yoga Maya is to expand the loving relationships, to increase the rasa. So, Prabhupada says, when Nanda Maharaj was taken away by Varuna, he saw Krishna's opulence. You remember when he was when Varuna stole Krishna, and then Krishna went and got him back. And of course, Varuna did this just so he could see Krishna and worship Krishna. Then he brings him back, and he shows Goloka to Nanda, like this will be your destination. And here's what it says: when Nanda Maharaj was taken away by Varuna, he saw Krishna's opulence, but nonetheless, he thought of Krishna as his son. Such feelings of parental love in the spiritual world are acts of Yoga Maya, not Mahamaya. This is the opinion of Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura. Now, interesting. Sometimes we see in different pastimes that even these intimate devotees that have these, like the coward boys who are in Sakya Rasa, we have, of course, the gopis in Madhurya Rasa, and the parents and other elders in Vatsalya Rasa, they sometimes get glimpses that Krishna is God. He gives those indications. He showed Mother Yashoda, right, the whole cosmic manifestation in his mouth. But Sanatana Goswami said in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita an interesting thing. He said, knowledge of Krishna's, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have a quote, knowledge of Krishna's position neither increases or decreases the devotee's love and their rasa. In other words, for somebody who was seeing Krishna in awe and reverence, knowledge of his position would increase that, right? They said, if you got this really realization of how great and opulent and wonderful Krishna was, you would feel even more in that particular rasa. You know, maybe a servant or whatever, just seeing Krishna's greatness and opulence. But that wouldn't really work for the Vraja Vasis, for the devotees in Vrindavan and these other rasas, because it interferes with it. It diminishes it. So it doesn't increase or decrease. So it's interesting. So, like for instance, with Nanda Maharaj, remember at the name-giving ceremony at Krishna's birth, Gargamuni gave a little indication. He said, your son will have all this great... He said, he will be as good as Narayan. Now, what does that mean? Well, Gargamuni knew he is Narayan. He's actually the origin of Narayan. But Nanda thought, that must mean he's empowered by Narayan. So when Krishna did these wonderful things like kill demons and things that were obviously things that little boys don't usually do, lifting up mountains, things like that, he would assume that Krishna was empowered by Narayan. Or Narayan is protecting him, and Narayan does all these things for him. You know, so because otherwise, you know, it's like it's really hard to see that, you know, just love this little cute child and think he's actually a Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, it doesn't really work. It interferes with the rasa. So that's where the Yoga Maya is so beneficial for the devotees. So Yoga Maya has several purposes. First, she arranges Krishna's pastimes. Everything that goes on there and all these intricate pastimes, Yoga Maya arranges. And of course, in Vrindavan, Yoga Maya appears as Purnamasi. And Purnamasi is making all these arrangements. And sometimes even Krishna wonders what she'll arrange. You think, I wonder what Purnamasi is, how she's going to work this out, how she's going to figure this out, you know. Oh, just as a side, it's kind of interesting. I just learned this recently, reading Gopal Chandra, that, of course, Purnamasi appears as this elderly Brahmani, you know, and she's really revered by everyone in Vrindavan. They all think of her, she's like the guru of Vrindavan. Right. Well, Gargamuni's a guru, but he's actually lived somewhere else. But in Vrindavan, she lives by an little hut by the Yamuna, and everyone thinks of her as the guru. Anyway, so she's this Brahmin woman, and her son is Sandapani Muni, who was, of course, Krishna's teacher in the Gurukula, and she's the grandmother of Mata Mangala. Right? So, and which is, I always thought, is interesting, because you always think of Mata Mangala, he's this sort of funny fellow, you know, and he's a Brahmin, but he hangs out with the coward boys, right? You know, he's like, but he's actually, Krishna is one of his closest friends, closest advisors. Kind of like how Uddhava is in Mathura and Dwarka, you know, really close, confidential advisor. Well, Mata Mangala kind of plays that part with Krishna, too. fact, sometimes Purnamasi Madhumangal will go to Krishna and talk about, well, what are you going to do here about Radharani? And they go, you know, and all of these things. And they make all these arrangements. In fact, in the first instance, it's all under Krishna. You know, it's like Krishna arranges this. He sets it up this way. It's not that, obviously, that Yogamaya is in control of Krishna. But, you know, because otherwise, if he knows everything and he plans it all in advance, then it's not that much fun. I mean, I'm saying it kind of loosely, but you know what I mean. For him to enjoy the rasa, to fully, you know, appreciate it, he wants to be a little bit surprised sometimes. What's going to happen? So, what was I going to say about that? So, sometimes Krishna actually even forgets himself. Oh, here, this is from a purport of Srila Prabhupada in the Chaitanya Lila Adi 429. Yogamaya is the name of the internal potency that makes the Lord forget himself and become an object of love for his pure devotee in different transcendental mellows. Think, well, how could Krishna forget himself? He's supremely omniscient, omnipotent, he knows everything, past, present, and future, trikalagya. I mean, how could he not? How could he forget himself? I was thinking of a couple of examples. I always like this example. I heard it first from Hridayananda Maharaj. He said, think of it as like, you know, this would apply to both the devotees, probably, and Krishna. It's like you're in a movie. You're watching a movie or you're watching a play, a dramatic presentation. Now, you get really absorbed in it, you know, and you're watching it, you're into it and all that. And the person next to you, your friend who's sitting next to you, says, hey, you know, this isn't real. This is really just a movie. I mean, you know who you are. You're really this. And he said, be quiet. You're ruining the movie, right? In other words, yeah, okay. He said, I guess I know. I'm the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and I have to create universes and, you know, do all this other stuff. But right now, I'm trying to enjoy this this experience. I'm enjoying relationships. I'm enjoying vasa and love with my devotees. So then another example, Prabhupada gave the example of, like, a Supreme Court justice. You know, because they are the President of the United States. Very famous, very powerful, important person, you know, like a Ishvara, you know. So he comes home, and he's with his children. Do they care that he's the Supreme Court Justice? Not so much. They just see him as their father, or his wife sees him as their husband. And they're enjoying that relationship. So someone might say to the kid, you know, did you know your father's Supreme Court Justice? Oh, really? That's interesting. Hey, Dad, can we go out and play? You know, I mean, you know, it's like, and the coward boys were kind of like that. Sometimes the coward boys would, you know, they'd get glimpses of Krishna was very powerful, that he was supreme. Think, oh, okay, let's go play ball with Krishna. It's like the demigods would sometimes come and they would, like, you know, be glorifying prayers and doing a whole thing with Krishna and Vrindavan. The coward boys would be watching it. You know what they'd do afterwards? They'd make fun of them. Right? They would imitate the demigods. And they were so irreverent. You know how 10-year-old boys are. So, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, Krishna's this, but we don't care. He's just our friend, and we love him. He's so so it's the sweetness of Krishna. That's the difference with these rasas. In Vrindavan, everything is about Krishna's sweetness and his love and relationship. And secondarily, yeah, he may have some other powers. So even if he's a famous person, we don't really care so much. But Yogamaya, for those of us who are not on that level of the coward boys and the gopis and Vrindavan yet, Yogamaya also allows the devotees to know Krishna. Srila Prabhupada says in purport, Bhagavatam 2746, the Lord is unlimited and by the grace of Yogamaya helps the surrendered soul to know him proportionally with the advance of one's surrender. So as one advances, as one surrenders to Krishna, it's kind of like the curtain of Mahamaya lifts and Yogamaya comes in. And Yogamaya, being under the spiritual energy, is always directing us to Krishna and helping us to advance, to know Krishna, and to love Krishna. And of course, the devotee is always under the internal protection, the internal potency, the protection, and that's Yogamaya. Here's from purport Bhagavatam 3.23.10, Prabhupada says, Devahuti knew that her husband was in a highly elevated transcendental position and was under the shelter of Yogamaya. As marginal energy, a person may be under the material energy or the spiritual energy, Yogamaya. Kardamuni Muni was a great soul under the spiritual energy, which means that he was directly connected with the Supreme Lord. So, All of Krishna's energies are working, and they are very inconceivable, they are numerous, they are countless, and they can help Krishna perform wonderful activities, and they also help the devotee to come closer to Krishna and to realize our relationship more and more and enjoy that relationship of love with Krishna. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Yes?
I was wondering.
Well, wait for the microphone.
Yeah, I was wondering, yesterday I was reading Nectar Devotion, and it was the chapter on servitude.
On what?
Servitude.
Servitude, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dasha, yeah.
Yeah, and in that chapter it says that in Dwapara, the Krishna has all his personal, like, counselors, friends, a whole list of different things.
Yeah.
And it named them all, right? There was all a set of names for each of these different categories of persons who were Krishna's close associates.
Okay.
So I was wondering, if Krishna expanded into 16,108 Krishnas, where were they? Were they in like one palace, or were they in all the palaces? Were they also expanded?
Okay, Krishna expands to 16,108 husbands of all of the queens, and so you're talking about these other devotees that are different roles and different servants and like that. You're saying what?
And how, their names are there. They're named in the Nectar Devotion.
Yeah. Well, they're experiencing Krishna also. I mean, he can expand to more than 16,000 forms. He can, you know, like sometimes Krishna will, you know, be like in the assembly hall, and he's got all the people around him like that. You know, so he's there. So basically, now, once I saw it described as when he left the house, his house with all of his queens, all the forms sometimes would merge back into one. So, in other words, the other people who weren't involved in that, the counselors and the servants like that, they didn't necessarily see 16,000 different Krishnas. In other words, the forms can merge back. They can come and go, and he can do whatever he wants. So then they would just see Krishna there and work, as far as I understand.
So, but are those individual personalities, do they expand?
Do they expand?
Yeah.
They can. Individual personality, it can happen. Well, for instance, take the queens of Dwarka. They were all the 16,000 gopis. The eight principal queens were the eight principal gopis, you know. Radharani becomes Satyabhama, you know. Chandravali becomes Rukmini, like that. So, yeah, there's, of course, they're like special category, you know. But sometimes, this is all in, see, it's all enchanted, it's all inconceivable. For instance, Sanatana Goswami explains in Brihad Bhagavatamrita a lot of it's about different expansions of the devotees simultaneously. Like Nanda Maharaj, you know, in Vaikuntha, two of the, I don't know if they're gatekeepers or whatever, two of the, or Nanda and Sunanda, they're in Vaikuntha, they're mentioned. Now, they're the same Nanda and Sunanda, his brother, who are in Vrindavan. And Nanda's also a demigod. You know, so he has three different, you know, different forms. Yeah, I don't pretend to try to understand it, but I think it's really amazing and interesting. We can just appreciate it, you know. Yeah. Okay, it's probably in class. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.